America Looks Abroad. This is the 55th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association, a nonpartisan organization which offers accurate information on world affairs. Today's subject is Inside Germany. The speaker is Mr. John C. DeWilde, Foreign Policy Association expert who follows international events in Germany. Mr. DeWilde.
Last Tuesday, on the eve of another winter of warfare and privation, the German Führer gave a pep talk. With this characteristic flair for drama, Hitler chose as a setting the shiny steel guns of a great munitions plant. And he addressed his remarks, above all, to the millions of workers who are laboring long hours in the armament factories throughout Greater Germany. Three things stood out in his speech. The first was the great emphasis laid on the Nazi thesis that the war is essentially a struggle between rich and poor, with Germany espousing the cause of the expropriated against the capitalistic democracies. Hitler depicted himself as the representative of the have-nots, the champion of the laboring masses in a titanic fight to break the power of gold and capitalism. 85 million Germans, he said, have 600,000 square miles at their disposal, while 46 million English have 40 million square kilometers. To the eradication of this alleged uneven distribution of living space, he pledged himself. Secondly, there was the confident reaffirmation of his belief in a final German victory. In strident tones, he cried out, "There will be no defeat in Germany, either military or economic, on the grounds of time. In our lexicon, there's no such word as capitulation." Finally, there were the hopes held out for the future. "When this war is over," Hitler promised, "the great work of creation is to begin in Germany. My ambition is to make the German people rich and the German land beautiful." We can imagine that at this point, the Führer's voice became less harsh and more persuasive. "We want a state," he said, "in which birth matters nothing and achievement means everything. Our ideal is that every position in the country shall be filled by a true son of the people." In reviewing this speech, one wonders why Hitler chose this time to make it. Are the German people beginning to lose confidence, despite the victories won by the German army and air force? Is the prospect of a long war terrifying to many Germans who remember the outcome of the last one? Are supplies of foodstuffs and raw materials running dangerously short? Few people can pretend to answer these questions accurately. Dr. Goebbels and Heinrich Himmler, the chief of the all-pervasive German secret police, may take informal polls of public opinion now and then, but if so, they are not publishing the results to the world. Yet, we can perhaps assemble a few facts which may permit some tentative deductions. Let us take the question of supplies. Germany does not appear to be suffering from any critical shortage of raw materials. When she entered the war, the iron ore supply threatened to be a serious bottleneck in the German war economy. Now, French Lorraine, which has been annexed by the Reich, can fully supply the deficiency. In sharp contrast, Britain has now been almost completely cut off from the European supplies of ore on which her iron and steel industry depended to a large extent. At one time, there was also a danger that Germany might not have enough raw material to make the aluminum needed for the thousands of bombers. France again is making up this deficiency, while Britain must rely on far-off Canada for most of her aluminum. There is undoubtedly a relative shortage of many non-ferrous metals like copper, and of such ferroalloys as nickel, chromium, manganese, and tungsten. Yet the Nazis laid in sizable reserves before the war and have rationed the consumption of all these minerals most carefully. But what about oil, you will ask? Here it is more difficult to give an opinion. Germany herself produces about 1 million tons of natural crude oil and probably a couple million tons of synthetic gasoline. The Soviet Union may furnish almost 1 million tons yearly, although we have no reliable figures on this point. A few months ago, the Russians and Germans completed the construction of freight yards and pumping facilities on the Russo-German border, which makes possible the rapid and efficient transfer of oil from Russian to German tank cars. In addition, the Axis powers now monopolize the 6 million ton output of Romania. With these sources of supply, while these sources of supply seem more than ample, lack of adequate transportation facilities probably limits Germany's ability to draw on Russia and Romania. Moreover, we don't know to what extent German refineries and synthetic gasoline plants have been affected by British air attacks. British bombers have repeatedly concentrated on these targets and must have done some damage. But it would probably be safe to conclude that Germany still has enough oil to carry on the air warfare against Britain. Not much is needed for this purpose. The conquered territories have certainly made substantial contributions, some temporary, some more or less permanent, to Germany's industrial resources. A German economic weekly, which has recently come into my hands, frankly admits that Germany's conduct in these countries is guided only by the iron rule that everything is justified which ensures a final victory. This publication takes great pride in the efficiency with which the economic section of the army staff follows up every conquest. A diligent search is made for stocks of raw materials and finished goods, and wherever they are found, a sign requisitioned by the German high command immediately goes up. There is also an immediate inventory of all industrial facilities to uncover anything that might be useful in overcoming any bottlenecks in Germany. In some cases, machinery is simply dismounted and transported to the Reich. Thus, in the Paris area, as this German periodical proudly admits, some 2,000 machines were carted away. In other cases, where it is more advisable to utilize labor and supplies on the spot, the factories get subcontracts for the German army, which they have to carry out under German commissars. The conquered territories also constitute a labor reservoir for Germany. More than 1 million prisoners of war are at work in German factories and on farms. Thousands of unemployed Frenchmen, Hollanders, Belgians, and Norwegians have been persuaded, as the Nazis put it, to take jobs in Germany. They afford considerable help to a country which suffers from an acute shortage of manpower. In financing the war, the Nazi government is apparently meeting with no serious difficulties. Most people express amazement that Germany can find the necessary funds. Just this week, one of our listeners has written in, wondering how it is possible for a country which is supposed to be so poor to finance a war. Paradoxically enough, Germany has been able to pay for the war primarily because she is so poor. That is, poor in goods which people can buy. The German people, who are working hard and long hours, are actually earning more money than before the war. But they can only spend a small portion of it, because most of the goods produced are for war, thus leaving a relatively small part for civilian consumption. And what people can't spend, the government absorbs, either in the form of loans or taxes. While all this evidence testifies to Germany's material ability to continue the war, it indicates little or nothing about civilian morale. That is determined much more by the effectiveness of Britain's air warfare, by the adequacy of food and clothing, and by the hope, if any, of a German victory in the not-too-distant future. Up to the present, the air raids on Germany have by no means attained the intensity and scope of those on Britain. In some sections of northern Germany, notably in Hamburg, Bremen, and Kiel, and in the industrial Rhineland, bombing raids have been frequent enough to compel people to spend almost every night huddled in air raid shelters. But for the majority of the German people, such raids are probably still something of a novelty. And there are certainly no towns like Coventry, Southampton, and Birmingham, which have been subjected to wholesale destruction. The testimony of neutral observers indicates, however, that civilian morale isn't entirely satisfactory. There's widespread gloom and apathy. No doubt, the Germans have been keenly disappointed that the victory, which seemed within their grasp last June and July, has still not been realized. They do not relish the prospect of another winter of warfare on short rations. True, the clothing allowance this year is slightly better than last, in part because the wardrobe of many Germans undoubtedly needs to be replaced, and in part because some Soviet cotton has become available, and stocks of other textile raw materials have been seized in the conquered countries. The government has repeatedly assured the people that there will be enough coal on hand, so that they will not have to shiver through this winter as they did last year. Even so, the supply will hardly permit German families to keep more than one room heated. So far, the government has avoided cutting the food rations, probably in the conviction that the German diet is already sufficiently restricted and monotonous. While bread, flour, and potatoes are plentiful, vegetables and fruit are very hard to get. This summer, there was a very good supply of vegetables, but a shortage of tin prevented much canning. The fruit crop, on the whole, was a failure. The way in which passers-by in Berlin recently pounced on the contents of an upset apple cart shows how apples are coveted by Germans in these days. The present meat ration can probably be maintained, but German housewives are much more concerned about the supply of butter and other fats. The shortage of fodder has decreased milk yields, and the German government will probably have to dip into its reserves of fats. In the current Christmas season, the German housewife is finding shopping more difficult than ever, whether for food or for presents. And this is a cheerless prospect indeed for a nation which has always attached great value to the proper celebration of Christmas. Hitler's speech, to which I alluded at the beginning, was probably designed to encourage the people to bear their sacrifices still longer. It was one of many efforts recently made to bolster morale. Most of these have been made to keep the people popular, keep the regime popular with the working classes on whom the war effort so largely depends. Premiums for overtime work, for example, were restored this fall, and the administration of the war income tax was recently adjusted so as to lessen the burden on those with small incomes. Additional food was also assigned to the kitchens of those factories in which employees were working long hours on the manufacture of munitions. Above all, The German government has focused rose-colored glasses on the social and economic conditions that are to prevail after the war. Numerous articles in newspapers and periodicals have set forth plans for the economic reorganization of Europe, which would inaugurate a new era of peace and plenty for all. Dr. Ley, who marshals the Nazi labor front, has painted a post-war picture in which any German father would pack his wife and three or four children into a people's car and travel all over the continent in the search of pleasure and culture. All this, Hitler has proclaimed, is part of the Nazi aim to create a model socialist state and ensure full employment after the war. The available evidence does not permit very definite conclusions. There appears to be no likelihood that Germany will break down internally for material or for moral reasons, at least as long as there is even a small hope of victory. There are perhaps only two ways in which Germany can be defeated. On the one hand, by greatly intensified air raids on such a scale as to demoralize the German populace. On the other, a persuasive and astute campaign designed to convince the German people that the post-war settlement will be constructive rather than vindictive.
Mr. John C. DeWilde, Research Associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. If you'd like a free copy of this talk, address your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 22 East 38th Street, New York, or in care of the station to which you are listening. We'll repeat the address, the Foreign Policy Association, 22 East 38th Street, New York, or in care of the station to which you are listening. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in American foreign policy. It offers accurate information on current world happenings. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This program originated in the studios of WFIL, and this is the National Broadcasting Company.